We're just going to get started. We are about a couple minutes past the hour, and I'm going to make sure we have time for questions and answers at the end. So thank you so much for coming here today. I'm Dr. Yael Harris in the Office of Disease Prevention and Health Promotion within the Office of the Assistant Secretary, and this is a session on integrating of public health into state and local health efforts. So thank you for coming here today. The first presenter will actually be Dr. Dawn Wright, who is the Deputy Assistant Secretary for Health and also leads the Office of Disease Prevention and Health Promotion in the Office of the Assistant Secretary for HHS. In this role, he has broad responsibility for enhancing the quality of health care provided to all Americans. Prior to this role, Dr. Wright served as the Principal Deputy Assistant Secretary for Health and also advised the Assistant Secretary for Health on matters involving public health and science. Dr. Wright also served as alternate United States Delegate to the World Health Organization Executive Board. And prior to joining HHS, he served as the Director of the Office of Occupational Medicine within the Occupational Safety and Health Administration, OSHA. He has a medical degree from the University of Texas, and he completed his family medicine residency at Baylor College of Medicine, and he also holds an MPH. Thank you, Dr. Wright.
Thanks, Yael. Well, welcome to this session on healthcare-associated infections. It's truly a topic that's near and dear to my heart. I think hopefully over the next hour and a half, you'll see the broad interest in this topic, starting with the leadership we provided in the federal family, what's happening at the state level, and what's happening at the local level. And I have to say it's been very rewarding that once all those efforts from the federal leadership down to the local efforts, we have seen the needle move, and I'm going to have an opportunity to show you the improvements that we've seen over the last 5 years in the reduction of healthcare-associated infections. As Yael mentioned, I'm Dawn Wright. I'm one of the Deputy Assistant Secretaries, and I've had the pleasure of leading or coordinating the healthcare-associated infection reduction effort at HHS since 2008. And over the next hour, I'm going to tell you about the next few minutes, I'm going to tell you about that effort. I always think it's good to talk a little bit about burden to set the stage and to give you a little bit of perspective. CDC recently released this factoid stating that one out of every 20 hospitalized patients will acquire a healthcare-associated infection, a significant number. Clearly, that's an important issue in human terms. Clearly, it's an important issue in patient safety terms. But I also want to point out to you that it's a very important issue in financial terms. The dollar amount associated with healthcare-associated infections is about $28 to $32 billion extra healthcare costs each and every year in what are largely preventable infections. So important in human terms, but also important in economic terms. So, what has been the federal effort and why are we so interested in this issue? First of all, I have to tell you that I think that HHS has been interested in reducing healthcare-associated infections for decades, but it was actually this report that heightened our awareness and really caused us to refocus our efforts and recommit to reducing healthcare-associated infections. This report, the GAO report, was released in March of 2008, and I think the title tells it all. Healthcare-associated infections in hospitals, leadership needed from HHS. You know, if you read that report, you would see that they acknowledged some good work at HHS, but it was critical of our effort in a number of areas. Although there was a lot of work that was going on at the department, they felt that it lacked central coordination to ensure that we were using all tools that we had at our disposal in a leveraged and consistent fashion. And they wanted us to improve in central coordination. They also wanted us to prioritize some of the guidelines we have so that we would highlight those practices that are most effective in reducing those infections. And the last recommendation the GOA made to the department is they wanted us to exploit health IT to ensure that it was maximally utilized to reduce these infections. As a result of that GAO report, the Deputy Assistant Secretary created a senior level steering committee for the reduction of healthcare-associated infections, and I've had the pleasure of leading that group for the last several years. As you can see, within HHS, we have broad participation from across the department, but we didn't want this to be just an HHS effort, and so we have participants across the federal family. The Department of Defense, with their large number of health facilities, participates. The Veterans Administration is integral to our work, as is the Department of Labor. This is how we accomplish our work. On the left-hand side is the senior-level steering committee that's kind of the oversight body of the work that occurs at HHS. But most of the heavy lifting actually occurs in the work groups that are on the right side of the slide. Now, I also want to point out that our work has been phased. In phase one, which we began immediately after the report was printed, focused just on acute care hospitals and trying to reduce those infections. And we looked at it from a number of areas. There was a work group that focused on prevention and implementation. What are those prevention guidelines, and how can we implement those maximally across the country? There was a research working group that looked at the existing body of knowledge. What is it that we know about these infections? What do we not know? And then from that, they created a research agenda that we, through NIH, could move forward. Incentives and oversight, chaired by CMS, looked at how we could maximize both financial incentives and market-driven incentives to reduce these infections. And then they also looked at how CMS, as an oversight body, the survey body of hospitals, could go into hospitals and look at them very critically with an infection control lens. There was an IT group that focused on the IT issues, and an outreach and messaging group that created a public awareness campaign. Phase one was actually followed by phase two, where we moved out of acute care settings into ambulatory surgical centers, end-stage renal disease facilities. And there was also an effort to see what we could do to encourage increased rates of immunization for seasonal influenza among healthcare workers. Most recently, we completed phase three, which focused on long-term care. So we're broadening the scope of our effort across the federal family. Well, what about the action plan? When the Deputy Secretary asked me to chair this group, he gave me the charge that he wanted a national action plan released that would provide leadership across the country for the reduction of healthcare-associated infections, and that's what we've done. The initial action plan was released in June of 2009. It's been updated since that time. As I mentioned earlier, we focused initially just on acute care hospitals, and we limited our efforts to what I call the big four: central line-associated bloodstream infections, catheter-associated urinary tract infections, surgical site infections, ventilator-associated pneumonia, and we had two focus areas on organism-specific pathogens as well, that of MRSA and Clostridium difficile. And if you lumped all those together, we would have covered with the action plan about 80% of the hospital-acquired infections. As it relates to the action plan, we were convinced from day one that this was going to be a living document, that we were going to publish it, but that we would update it periodically as the science evolved and as we understood what strategies were most effective. So it was released in 2009. Then it was updated just this past year in 2013. We summarized the progress to date, and we identified new strategies, and we expanded it to the outpatient settings that I mentioned. Let me say, when the Recovery Act dollars came available, there was in the appropriations bill, there was a requirement that each state create a state action plan that cascaded down from our national plan and that had some target measures. One thing I left out in talking about the action plan, it was the Deputy Secretary ask us to create some five-year targets that would really benchmark our success and hold us accountable for progress longitudinally moving forward. And so that initial action plan that we released in 2009 had some five-year targets that went from 2008 to 2013. I think this may be the most important slide, at least in my presentation, because it shows where we are and how we progressed since we created these targets in 2008. If you look at the top there, in 2008, we said as a nation, we wanted to reduce central line-associated bloodstream infections by 50% over a five-year period. And the end of that period will be December 31st of this year. Today, I'm very pleased to say that as a nation, we will not only meet that goal, but that we will most likely significantly exceed that goal. After 3.5 years, we already had a 49% reduction in central line-associated bloodstream infections across the nation. I'll come back to Clostridium difficile, but if you'll go on down to the catheter-associated urinary tract infections, we wanted a 25% reduction over that five-year period. We have made progress in that area. Unfortunately, we are not on pace to reach that goal of 25%. We had some initial improvement with a slight fallback, and now we think we're on track to pick up and continue those reduction efforts, but most likely we will not reach that 25% reduction. As it relates to invasive MRSA infections, we wanted a 50% reduction nationally. And again, we're on track to meet or exceed that goal by the end of the target period. Moving on down to surgical site infections, we wanted a 25% reduction over that five-year period of time. And again, we're on track to meet that goal nationally. And the last was a process measure, the skip measures. We wanted 95% adherence to the skip measures. We're well beyond that, I think up in the 98 to 99% adherence rate. Been so successful in that process measure that most likely that measure will be retired moving forward. So as a whole, we're making good progress. Don't get me wrong, there's still a great deal of work to be done. I wanted to go back and focus on that second area of Clostridium difficile. Unfortunately, this is the one area that we have made little, if any, progress to date. We think that there's been a plateau in this area, and certainly there are some states and certain regions within the country that have been more successful in reducing Clostridium difficile infection, but this will definitely be a focus moving forward because it's the one area in the action plan that we have not had the success that we've had in other areas. I want to say that success is really related to three things. One is the contributions across the federal family, and you can see whether it's surveillance, whether it's research or education, there is broad support through the major operating divisions of HHS. Clearly, that's important in providing leadership for the nation, but it's what happens at the state and local level that really moves the needle. Hopefully, our efforts provide the overall framework and some leadership to that effort, but it's those of you that work in the field that really make the difference. I did want to highlight a little bit of the work across the federal family that I think has been so instrumental. When we talk about the Center for Disease Control and Prevention, we think of their surveillance systems. We would not be able to monitor where we are, what our baseline is, or what our success in reducing these infections is without good surveillance systems. And the National Healthcare Safety Network, in many ways, has become the predominant surveillance system for following those infections. And I'll share with you in an upcoming slide of how widely it's been used. They also have the emerging infection programs that allows it to find more detailed information about instances of some of these infections. It's not across the entire United States, but does affect about 40 million healthcare consumers and provides additional information. So there's two very strong and robust surveillance systems from CDC that monitor our success. I have to say that we have seen great value to publicly reporting of HAI rates. If you go back to 2004, you'll see that there are only four states that had state mandates, and again, this is based on state law, not federal law, that required publicly reporting of infections, and that was 2004. If you fast forward to January of this year, you'll see a marked difference that suddenly there's 30 states, including the District of Columbia, that require mandated public reporting of healthcare-associated infection numbers. And I'll have to tell you, many of the states that still remain white on that slide, there is pending legislation. So I believe that that map is going to continue to become more green over the upcoming months and years, and eventually public reporting will be virtually universal. The thought behind public reporting, as you can imagine, is to provide healthcare consumers as much information as they need to make informed decisions about where they get their care. Certainly, I think that's beneficial, but I found it to be even more beneficial to the hospital themselves. There's no hospital that wants to receive a bad score, and so if their public reporting for one of these infections is high, it causes them to redouble their efforts to lower their infection rate for the next public reporting time period. Well, how widely is reporting? As you can see, as it relates to acute care hospitals, there's 5,500, which is virtually all, not quite all, but most, nearly every hospital is reporting to NHSN as it relates to healthcare-associated infections through NHSN. As it relates to CLABSI, CAUTI, and SSI, they're in the 4,000 range and growing. I think the areas that we continue to need to grow in are clearly in long-term care, where we just have a very small number of long-term care facilities actually reporting. Pennsylvania, I believe, is one of the states, as well as New York, that is requiring reporting of rates in long-term care facilities. And then ambulatory surgical facilities. Again, we have a long way to go as it relates to reporting infections out of those areas as well. Dialysis facilities have actually gotten on board, and there's widespread reporting through dialysis facilities. But I think you need to also realize, as it relates to dialysis care, most of that care is provided through Medicare services, and so we have the payment lever there to really encourage the reduction of healthcare-associated infections. But a large number of facilities are reporting, and we think that our data is robust, and we can stand behind the numbers that we're actually getting. The Agency for Healthcare Research and Quality, ARC, also has been integral in our success. I think over the last several years, they've invested over $50 million in reduction of healthcare-associated infections. When I look at ARC, I look at that really they're responsible is for taking these evidence-based practices that have been tested and shown to be successful and translating it to care at the bedside. How do we know, how can we take what we know works and make sure that it is implemented each time a patient receives care in this country? And they do a very good job with that. The CUSP initiative has probably been their most successful initiative to date. Many of you may know that. What they do is they take evidence-based practices, they combine that with a toolkit for the staff that implement that training. They insist on top management buy-in in the organization. And from that, they have seen some market improvement in healthcare in this country. Many of you are probably aware, it's almost a decade old now, but the Michigan Keystone Initiative that really set all this work into motion, where Dr. Pronovost went to Michigan and implemented a checklist that was used every time a central line was placed in an individual, and they took what were very high rates and brought them down to essentially zero and kept them at that level for over 5 years. And it was the basis of the CUSP initiative that I think is responsible, and then the wide dissemination out of Michigan across the country that is responsible for that greater than 50% reduction in central line associated bloodstream infections that we've seen. Center for Medicare and Medicaid Services, they probably have the most effective tool at their disposal, and that's the power of the purse. They pay for these things. And there's two different areas that they've used that strong power to try to reduce healthcare-associated infections. The first is through the inpatient prospective payment system. This is where a patient is paid a certain amount for a diagnosis, but if they have a additional conditions, such as a central line associated bloodstream infection, with the use of that modifier, they can get an increase in payment. Several years ago, CMS wanted to send the message that they were no longer going to pay for these infections, and so no, at this point in time, even with the modifier, they're not paid for these preventable infections. I have to say that the financial savings from this initiative have been somewhat modest. But I do think it sent a message across the country that government will not pay for preventable infections moving forward. We're excited about the second initiative that's just being rolled out, that of hospital value-based purchasing. When the Affordable Care Act was published in 2009, they called me and they said, "Are you aware that your action plan is in the Affordable Care Act?" And we weren't. The secretary in the Affordable Care Act was instructed or mandated to establish financial incentives for quality outcomes in healthcare. Now, she was given great latitude in what areas she focused on, but it was prescriptive in five areas that she must establish financial incentives around: congestive heart failure, around acute myocardial infarctions, around pneumonia, and around healthcare-associated infections using the targets in the action plan. And so you will see that rolling out very shortly as we establish a system to reward hospitals that have great outcomes in healthcare-associated infections. I want to say a little bit about our office and our role in this. Our role is primarily coordination and making sure that all the tools and levers that we have at our disposal in the federal family are maximally utilized to reduce those infections. But early on, we realized that one of the weaknesses in our current effort was the lack of workforce training. We heard it across the nation that many of the graduates from nursing school, medical school, and other professional schools were inadequately trained in basic infection control practices. And out of that, we created the Partnering to Heal video. It's on our website. It's received some national awards and has been well received from the community. You can play any one of those five characters at the bottom. It's a scenario-based computer training where each one of these professionals is faced with a decision that they have to make, and you can make a decision and then learn if you've gone down the right track or the wrong track. It's not actually, it's primarily professionals, but it also has a consumer component. The young lady on the left side of that slide is actually a family caregiver. Next to her is the head physician on that unit. The middle character is an infection preventionist. Next is Manuel, who is a medical student. And the last playable character is a nurse. I want to say that our efforts have been totally aligned with a larger effort within the department, that of Partnership for Patients. I think many of you that come from a healthcare community are familiar with Partnership for Patients. It was launched almost 3 years ago. And it had two goals. They were trying to reduce all-cause preventable harm in the hospital 40% over a three-year period of time, and they were trying to reduce preventable readmissions to the hospital, 30-day readmissions, by 20%. As it relates to the preventable harm, if you look at the nine areas they're following, four of those nine areas are the healthcare-associated infections that I mentioned earlier, the big four. So we've made sure that our efforts are dovetailed nicely with the Partnership for Patients initiative. The last thing I want to talk a little bit about is an effort that we have out of the Office of the Assistant Secretary to really reward and to highlight good work. Someone said early on to me when I was working on this initiative, Dr. Ryan, have you thought about doing something positive? Here you're taking money away from people, here you're making them publish bad results. Have you thought about doing something positive? And it was out of that that we created two awards programs. The first was with the Critical Care Society Collaborative. And that's actually a group of four organizations that all are involved in intensive care. It was the Association of Critical Care Nurses, the American Thoracic Society, the American College of Chest Physicians, and the Society of Critical Care Medicine. And so we have presented awards to a number of hospitals across the nation that have showed it exemplary work in reducing healthcare-associated infections in the intensive care type setting. More importantly is the second award that we created. It's the Partnership in Prevention Award, and we co-sponsor that with the Association for Professionals in Infection Control and Epidemiologists and the Society of Healthcare Epidemiology of America, the two premier groups in infection prevention. It is the national award that's presented once a year to the one hospital or hospital system in the nation that has the most exemplary record in reducing healthcare-associated infections. It's presented by our assistant secretary. We were anticipating presenting this award a couple of weeks ago, but the furlough made us reschedule that, and we will be presenting this award in a nationwide webinar on the 26th of this month. We're keeping the identity of the winner private until the award is presented. But I have to say, after looking through all the applications, they are more than worthy of such recognition for the work that they've done in reducing healthcare-associated infections. And that's an award that will continue. The second award, we've completed 3 years with the Critical Care Society, and that we're now in a three-year effort with the APIC and SHEA moving forward. So here's my contact information. Don't hesitate to reach out to me if you have any additional questions that you have. Also, you can subscribe to our listserv. We constantly put out information to those that are interested in healthcare-associated infections. Hopefully, you have a better idea of what we're doing at the federal level, but for those of you that work in the trenches, it's actually what you do that makes the greatest difference, so I applaud your efforts. Yeah?